in the Gospels, there is always something new and fascinating that we learn and glean from Jesus' life or his message. And this morning we come to an issue that oftentimes gets overlooked in the Christian life. We want to talk this morning about Jesus' response to fasting. I think it's an appropriate subject because as I've witnessed over the last two decades in our society, and even as I've witnessed my own waistline, we live in a society that is very enamored with food. Food has become another major idol in our culture. I mean, just think about how saturated our society, our mindset, the America that we live in is in regards to food. There is now on cable television channels, networks completely devoted to 24-hour programming just about food. Cooking shows, in fact, have become one of the fastest growing genres in media over the past 15 years. Prior to this wave, I can rarely recall a cooking show. I never saw The Galloping Gourmet. Anyone remember The Galloping Gourmet? I do remember Julia Childs and yes. But those were it. Now today, there are over 55 shows with a food theme. Shows like, and this might kind of whet your appetite for lunch, Unwrapped, Barefoot Contessa. You know, a show that has bare feet does not have any appeal to my appetite. Good Eats, one of my favorites, The Iron Chef. Not the American version, you got to get the Japanese version. Emerald Live, $40 a day, Calorie Commando. Has anyone seen Calorie Commando? Okay, Kyle has. All right, Food Nation, from Martha's Kitchen, Food 911, and a host of other shows and networks completely devoted to food. Right now, some of you are thinking about food as you ponder where to go for lunch after church today. And I guarantee that some of you, in the course of this day, you will talk about food. You will talk about your favorite foods. You will talk about your favorite desserts, your favorite restaurants, and best of all, you will talk about your food experiences. You know what those are, right? Those memorable meals that have stuck in your mind because of how fantastic the food tasted or how great the restaurant was, the dinner of surf and turf, the sushi gorging, the Italian feast, the Mexican fiesta, or the home-cooked meal from mom. We are a society that is saturated with food. In fact, just recently, I myself participated in the first annual FBC Meat Fest over at Steve and Karen Morgan's house. And we had pounds of Alaskan king crab legs, tri-tip. What else? I think that was it. We just ate meat and crab legs, and that's all we needed. And it was a fantastic experience, the Meat Fest. You may get invited to the second annual. You got to get in good with the Morgan family. But why are we going to talk about fasting in the midst of a society that is so enamored with food? My heart and my desire would be for us as a church to seriously consider the practice of this biblical discipline called fasting. That somehow, as we think about biblical fasting, Christian fasting, that we would ask the question, is the denial of our appetites, could the denial of certain bodily appetites express or even increase our desire for God? Is it possible that when we fast as believers, that somehow our appetite for God might increase all the more? Now, anytime we talk about self-denial, anytime we talk about abstinence, we run the risk and the danger of becoming legalistic. In fact, Scripture warns us about this. 1 Timothy 4, 1-3, the Spirit explicitly says that in the later times, some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons by means of the hypocrisy of liars seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron. And here it is, men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods, which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and know the truth. There's a danger. There's a warning there. Be careful when you start talking about such things as abstaining from food. Colossians 2, 20 and 21. If you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, and do not touch? Again, the whole issue of legalism presents the danger whenever we talk about the issue of fasting. And so we walk this narrow path as Christians. On one side of the cliff is self-denial. On the other side is self-indulgence. And yet there's this narrow pathway that I believe God would have us pursue that is the pathway of a passionate love for Christ. That when we are passionate and when we love Christ, we are able to walk in obedience to Christ and avoid the dangers of self-denial and legalism and avoid the dangers of self-indulgence and hedonism. And that we might learn the spiritual discipline and the benefits of Christian fasting. I think this is what Paul is alluding to in Philippians 3:8. More than that, he says, I count all things. In verse 7, actually verses 1 to 6, Paul has been speaking primarily about his Jewish heritage as the basis of his merit before Christ. In other words, he's just saying, I'm a good person, I was a good person, I was the best of the good, and therefore that is what earned me a place in heaven. And then he says, you know what, that is nothing to me. And then in verse 8 he says, more than that, I count now all things, not just my Jewish heritage, which was not a bad thing, it's a good thing. But now he says, anything that rivals Christ, anything that tempts me away from this intimate fellowship with Christ, he says, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, and I consider them rubbish. I think that is Paul's heart cry and his passionate pursuit, which simply says, you know what, I don't want even food to get in the way of my hunger for God. It's in these words of Christ that we will look at in Luke 5 where we find the roadmap to this path. Men and women, this message this morning is not about a laundry list of legalistic do's or don'ts. Bottom line, what Jesus is aiming at is the heart. What are you passionate about? One author said, what we hunger for most, that is what we worship. I believe that if we are those, as God's people, who are hungering and thirsting for God, that we would seriously consider Christian fasting as a means of growing in our hunger for God, growing in our knowledge of God. Well, last week we ended in Luke 5:32. Jesus has addressed the self-righteousness of the Pharisees, and we pick up the conversation that took place between them and Jesus. And remember the context that is surrounding today's passage. Jesus is addressing specifically the self-righteous pride and the arrogance of these legalistic, man-centered Pharisees. But what he's really doing is he's getting to a bigger issue. There's a much broader issue at stake with the Judaism of Jesus' day. And that issue is that Judaism was broken. It did not work. Why? Because it was a far cry from the Old Testament salvation that God had laid out to the forefathers of the faith, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, David, all the prophets, that they understood what true faith in Christ, true faith in God meant as they looked towards the future in the coming Messiah. But the modern-day Judaism that Jesus was a part of was so corrupted. It was a spiritually bankrupt religion. They were basing their access and their acceptance to God solely on their good works. Faith had very little to do with being a part of God's kingdom. It had primarily to do with men themselves, their heritage, and what they could do for God. And so Jesus, in a sense, is weaving the gospel into the hearts of those who are in the crowds and the multitudes and his disciples. So they look to Christ in verse 33. They question first his open association with tax collectors and sinners, and now they're going to question his piety. They're going to question whether or not he really is a godly teacher. Verse 33, and they said to him, the disciples of John often fast and offer prayers. The disciples of the Pharisees also do the same, but yours eat and drink. Now what's going on here? Why would the Pharisees pick up on what would seem to be a very minor issue in today's view of Christianity? And why would they make that the defining issue of whether or not Jesus Christ is a legitimate prophet, a legitimate teacher? Well, here's why. We know, first of all, that there was one appointed fast a year, and that was on the Day of Atonement. In Leviticus 16:29, it says, and it shall be a statute to you forever that in the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall afflict yourselves and shall do no work. And the Jews took that phrase, afflict yourselves, as being a fast from food. That's the way they practiced it. That's the way they understood it. I agree with that application, that interpretation. And so God called the nation of Israel by the Mosaic Law one time of year. Here's such an important day. Why? Because the Day of Atonement was the day of national contrition over sin. Fasting was associated with mourning. It was associated with a brokenness, a sorrow before God, grief. And so it made sense to fast on that day. Fasting was also used during specific times within Israel's history, times of penance, times when they were under the rule of a foreign nation and they wanted to be free, times when individuals were just struggling with trials and tribulation. The psalmist talks about fasting in Psalm 35:13. I afflicted myself with fasting. I prayed with head bowed on my chest. In the Old Testament, fasting was used as a means of showing God how serious you really were in regards to prayer. You didn't just pray, but you prayed with fasting. Why? Because you were earnest in your pursuit of God. You really were going after God. Now, what happened to fasting? What took place during the intermediate period, about 400 BC to the time of Christ, is that fasting evolved into a different lifestyle. It took on a life of its own, so to speak, and it became the distinguishing mark of a pious Jew. It became the means of earning merit from God. In other words, if you were really a pious Jew, you would, no doubt, be one who fasted. And you wouldn't just fast once a year or five times a year. No, by the time it came around to the time of Christ, Pharisees were fasting twice a week, on Mondays and Thursdays. That's what the Pharisee is saying in Luke 18 when he's talking to himself, praying to himself, I fast twice a week. It had become, note this, the distinguishing characteristic of godliness for the Jew. There are defining characteristics for Christians in different cultures, in different societies. Today, probably a characteristic that would define true godliness would be purity, integrity in our society. In other societies, what defines true godliness is maybe diligence or discipline. And you know what defined godliness for the Jew in the time of Christ? It was fasting. It was cutting off from yourself food so that you could show to God and to others how earnest you were for God. That became the distinguishing, defining mark. But what happened is that the Pharisees set up this standard. Really, it was their personal preference, their man-made standard. Nowhere in the law does it say you have to fast on Monday, you have to fast on Thursday. What they did was they established this twice-a-week fast as the standard for everybody. Therefore, if you didn't fast twice a week, like the Pharisees fasted, you weren't really serious. You weren't really earnest in your pursuit of God. And they used their personal preference as a gauge, and they laid it over everyone else's life, every other Jew's life, and they measured their piety based on this man-made standard. And guess what? They're doing the very same thing with Jesus Christ. They're looking at Christ, and they're saying, Jesus, we fast twice a week. What about you? How about your disciples? How come they're not doing what we are doing? Aren't you serious about God? Aren't you pious? Aren't you really pursuing godliness, Jesus? And in the classic core roots of legalism, they took their personal preference and they got it all confused with biblical principle. And out of pride and out of arrogance, they are going to judge the one who is the basis of all truth and all righteousness, the Holy One of God. They are now going to say, we don't think you cut it in regards to your personal and practical holiness. You see how dangerous this issue can be for us as God's people? I mean, it was so blinding for the Pharisees that they would, in their arrogance, challenge Jesus Christ. And we too, men and women, will find much danger for our soul when we do the same. Luke 5:33, they asked Jesus, the disciples of John, fast. Disciples of the Pharisees do the same, but yours eat and drink. I think Matthew's party that we talked about last week took place either on Monday or either on Thursday. And when the Pharisees got wind of this, they had been fasting all day. And Jesus and his disciples, what have they been doing? They've been eating all day. They've been partying all day. They've been feasting and eating. And here come these gloomy-faced Pharisees walking up to Jesus. They're probably hungry. Now, what's interesting about this is that in Mark chapter 2, verse 18, it says, now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. In fact, the disciples of John are lumped together with the Pharisees. In fact, in Matthew's account, Matthew 9, it says the disciples of John came to Jesus saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? So we know, based on all the accounts of the gospel writers, that it would be safe to assume that both the Pharisees and the disciples of John came to Jesus, and they both questioned Jesus. Now, why the disciples of John? Why are they here? We thought these were believers. We thought they were faithful. I think there's several reasons why they're lumped together. First of all, John led an ascetic lifestyle. He lived out in the wilderness. He had clothes made out of camel's hair. He ate locusts and honey. He was an ascetic. We know from Jewish history that he was most likely a part of an ascetic Jewish group called the Essenes. Men who lived in the caves, out in the wilderness, and they were so fed up with modern contemporary Judaism that they said, we want out of that. We're just going to get out of here and we're going to live this monk-style life. And they thought that would make them holier. And yet we know that John was a believer. He was saved in his mother's womb. And yet he led an ascetic lifestyle which probably appealed to his disciples. Second, we know that John's disciples maintained a distinction between themselves and the followers of Christ. So they misunderstood who Jesus really was. At one point, they even sent a delegation to Christ to figure out if he really is the Messiah. And so there's some confusion in the minds of the disciples of John. But I think this is probably the issue that was most persuasive for any Jew. Fasting had become such a prevalent practice within Jewish society, no one questioned the motives behind the practice, even the disciples of John the Baptist. And so here are these two groups. We know for sure that the Pharisees did not have good intentions. In fact, this blows up into a bigger issue regarding the Sabbath that we'll find in the weeks ahead, that their man-made traditions were now being challenged. And therefore, they become very, very angry with Jesus. And so both groups come and they question Jesus. Why do we fast? Your disciples don't. They're out partying with tax collectors and sinners. We, Mondays and Thursdays, are faithfully fasting. Well, notice the first part of Jesus' answer. Look with me in verses 34 to 35. Jesus said to them, "Can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days." Jesus explains his answer to the Pharisees in two parts. In verses 34 and 35, he's going to give an immediate explanation to the question that they've asked. And then in verses 36 to 39, he's going to give the rationale behind this explanation as he uses a parable, several parables, to give the reason and the motive behind fasting. And what Jesus is ultimately doing, as I mentioned earlier, is he's getting to the heart of this man-centered traditional Judaism of the day. Think about it, men and women. Judaism at this time, if someone bought into it, would not save. It was a deceptive facade of a religion that if someone bought into it, bought into their traditions, what was Judaism at that time, they would go to hell. They would be condemned to hell. The nation of Israel had so far wandered from the Old Testament plan of God for salvation that their understanding of what it took for a Jew to be saved was so erroneous that that error now led into their sanctification. They didn't have a clue on what it meant to be a godly individual before God. And so Jesus is not just tackling fasting, although that is a specific application of this text. What he's really addressing is the broader heart issue of what it takes for his fellow Jews to be part of the kingdom. They didn't understand that. And so he's trying to get them to understand that. Well, look at the first part of his answer, verse 34. Can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? Jesus is such a great teacher. He responds to their question, how? With a counter question. And he centers his answer around the illustration of a wedding. Weddings at this time were very, very different from weddings today. Don't think of the contemporary modern 21st or 20th century wedding and place our cultural understanding over the Bible. Weddings at this time were actually week-long feasts. And what would start off this wedding feast would be the groom's attendants. That's what Luke says here, the attendants of the groom. They were basically the wedding party. There would be a best man, but there would also be these other men. And what they would do is they would, in their finest clothing with the groom, they would parade down the streets from his house with tambourines and musical instruments, and they would be singing and dancing with joy, and they would go to the house of the bride. And there, they would grab the bride, and with her attendants, they would take the bride back to the groom's house, and there, that's where the wedding ceremony would take place, and that's where the wedding feast would then commence. Sometimes it would last up to 7 days. And weddings were huge celebrations, just like they are today. They were filled with joy. They were filled with food. And we go to weddings for the same reason. We want to share in the joy of that couple. No one goes to the wedding to get sad. No one goes to a wedding so that they can become more somber. No one goes to the wedding and you don't eat. Most weddings I've been to, the food is great. Weddings are a time of great joy and celebration. In fact, as a pastor, I get the privilege of getting a front row seat. I mean, literally, sometimes I'm like 2 feet away from this couple. They're kissing, they're talking, they're gazing in each other's eyes. And I almost feel like, wow, I shouldn't be standing here watching these people. But the joy, you can just sense the joy. You look over to the mom and dad, they're crying, they're happy. You look over to the other family, they're crying. You look out to the crowd, and everyone is happy. That's what a wedding depicts. And what Jesus is saying here is that in the same way, while Jesus is there the bridegroom, with the bride, and with the attendants, his disciples. It's not a time to fast. It's a time to rejoice. In fact, John the Baptist understood this. In John 3:29, it says this, "He who has the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him," and this is John referring to himself, "rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. So this joy of mine has been made full." John the Baptist recognized that by being in the presence of the Messiah, his joy was complete. Psalm 16:11, "In your presence is fullness of joy, in your right hand there are pleasures forever." Jesus was there, physically there, with his disciples. And therefore, it was not a time for mourning. It was not a time for sorrow. It was a time for rejoicing. Now look at the next verse. He explains some more. "The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days." What's he talking about? Jesus is referring to himself as the bridegroom. The attendants are the disciples. And he says, the days will come when the bridegroom is literally violently taken away from the attendants. And then they will fast in those days. The verb there, taken away, implies a violent removal of Christ. I believe this is a clear reference to his cross. The day will soon come when Jesus is violently taken away from the disciples, and then Jesus assumes that the disciples will fast. One commentator writes, "The resultant sorrow will provide a proper occasion for fasting as the appropriate expression of their true feelings." And it's in this period of time, while Jesus is physically separated from the bride, that's us, the church, that would have been the New Testament apostles, the New Testament church, he explains to us that fasting is an appropriate expression of our longings for his presence. Now note this. He is not setting up an ordinance for the church. He is not making a hard and fast rule. I'm going to talk about this later. Nowhere is fasting commanded in the New Testament. There's only one place in the Bible where it's commanded, and that's in Leviticus, under the Mosaic law. We are no longer bound by that law, and therefore for us as New Testament believers, fasting is not commanded. God is not saying you must fast. All right, we'll talk about that and explore that a little bit more. But based on his words here and in other places, I believe that fasting is expected. And I'll try to explain that. Now some might say, well, is Jesus opposed to fasting? Was he opposed to fasting while he was there on earth? No, he's not opposed to fasting. In fact, in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew 6, he gives clear instructions on how to fast. He says there, "Whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do. But when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that your fasting will not be noticed by men." Jesus was not saying you should not fast. But what he's getting at is now, because I'm here, there's a new kind of fast. The way that the Pharisees observed fasting, that wasn't the way God wanted fasting to be done. Now he brings on a new kind of fast. And fasting, as we understand it from what Jesus is saying here, is an expression of the soul's hunger for God. The reason why Jesus needed to explain fasting to these Pharisees is because they had turned fasting into this man-centered, traditional, legalistic, "Look at me, I'm fasting, see how spiritual I am," kind of discipline. They fasted to be noticed by people. They come out of their fast, put on a gloomy face, tell everyone about it. "Hey, what have you been doing?" "Oh, I've been fasting today. I fasted all day. I am starving, but I'm doing it for God." They fasted to earn merit from God. They fasted to appear religious and righteous. And Jesus is probably sitting back and asking the simple question, "Hey, Pharisees, where's God in your fasting? Where is God in your man-made traditions? Where is God? Where is the glory of God? Where does God get glory when you men fast for your own glory. God was completely missing from this equation of piety. And so Jesus isn't saying no fasting, but he's saying now there's a new fasting, a different kind of fasting that Judaism did not know. So let me conclude by answering just some practical questions concerning fasting. We're going to finish up next week with the motives and the reasons behind fasting as we look at the parables. But I mentioned at the start that my heart's desire would be for us to seriously contemplate and to consider fasting as a spiritual discipline. Why would I say that? Question number one, what is fasting? What is Christian fasting? Now, specifically speaking, fasting in the Bible is only tied to food. Fasting in the Bible is only tied to the abstinence of food. But because there is nothing inherently moral with eating or not eating, I believe that in application, Christian fasting can be applied to a broader scope beyond just food. That's my argument. That's my reason. That's why I would not just tie fasting to merely food. I would say that Christians can fast by abstaining from other things besides food. Other things that are acceptable. Other practices, not sin. Other things that we have freedom to engage in, such as eating. That fasting would now cover that. So here's my attempt to define Christian fasting for us today. Christian fasting is abstinence from food and anything else because of one's hunger for God. You're hungry for God. Your heart's heavy. You're lethargic. Your feet are dragging spiritually. And in your heart, you're feeling the pain of being separated in your communion and your fellowship with God. And one of the disciplines that is an option for believers, I believe, would be for us to fast. That's all I'm saying. That where there is a hunger for God, that Christians can use fasting as a means of stimulating that hunger more so for God. Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote this: "Fasting, if we conceive of it truly, must not be confined to the question of food and drink. Fasting should really be made to include abstinence from anything which is legitimate in and of itself for the sake of some special spiritual purpose. There are many bodily functions which are right and normal and perfectly legitimate, but which for special, peculiar reasons in certain circumstances should be controlled. That is fasting." So what does Christian fasting entail? Anything. Anything. It could be fasting from food. It could be fasting from television. It could be fasting from media. It could be fasting from sleep. It could be fasting, as 1 Corinthians 7 says, from the marriage bed. Christian fasting is abstinence from anything because of one's hunger for God. John Piper writes this: "As an act of faith, Christian fasting is an expression of dissatisfied contentment in the all-sufficiency of Christ. It is an expression of secure and happy longing for the fullness of Christ. Christian fasting does not tremble in the hope of earning anything from Christ. It looks away from itself to the payment of Calvary for every blessing it will ever receive. Christian fasting is not self-wrought discipline that tries to deserve more from God. It is a hunger for God, awakened by the taste of God, freely given in the gospel." So that is Christian fasting, I believe, for us today. It's abstaining from anything. Anything that might stoke a greater hunger for God. But the question that you're probably asking is, must I fast? Do we have to do this? I don't know if I could go a day without food. Are you telling me I have to fast? I don't know if I could go a week without television. I don't know if I could go a week without, you know, whatever it is. Are you saying I must do this? And this is where I want to answer the question I raised before. Fasting is nowhere commanded in the New Testament, and therefore it is voluntary. In fact, some have physical limitations that would keep them from fasting. God has not given us specific guidelines for when to fast or how often to fast. He has simply given us the general principles for why we fast. But He has made it clear that He expects us to fast. Matthew 6, 16, whenever you fast. Verse 17, when you fast. Luke 5, 35, the days will come, and when the bridegroom is taken away from them, then they will fast. And let's get some help from some men who are much smarter than me, much more mature, much more godly. John MacArthur, this indicates that fasting is assumed to be a normal part of one's spiritual life. It's an assumption. John Piper writes, is fasting Christian? It is if it comes from confidence in Christ and is sustained by the power of Christ and aims at the glory of Christ. Nothing wrong with that. Donald Whitney writes this, to those unfamiliar with fasting, the most surprising part may be the discovery that Jesus expected that His followers would fast. By giving us instructions on what to do and what not to do when we fast, Jesus assumes that we will fast. So what's the difference? What's the difference between a biblical command and a biblical expectation? I've wrestled with this question for a long time. Struggle with this ever since the day I worked through Matthew 6. What's he saying here? When you fast. We never find the verb fast in the imperative in the New Testament. You do a word search, you never find it in the imperative. Oftentimes it's just a participle. It's supporting another main verb. So what's the difference between a command and an expectation? And by the way, this is the best I can give you. All right, I'm sorry if this doesn't satisfy your every whim, and if you have other insights into this, I really would love to figure this out more. A biblical command governs a practice Christians must do. We have no option. We must do it, or it prohibits something that we must not do. We must not do it. There's never a time where we could do it if it's a prohibition. And God is saying we must do it, like prayer. Prayer. Pray without ceasing. Just constantly pray. Rejoice always. Do not be anxious. Never a point where a Christian can be sinfully anxious and get away with it. Those are absolute commands, but a biblical expectation motivates a practice that we should do. If biblical commands are here, I put biblical expectations right here. They're important. We should be doing these things. There's an assumption that Jesus has. He says, this is something that I expect you to do. But He doesn't command it. I guess maybe one way to understand where fasting fits into the Christian life is to see it from a different angle. This is always helpful. We would enact church discipline on someone for unrepentant, ongoing sin, such as adultery. But we would not do the same if someone hadn't fasted over the last year. How many of you have fasted this past year? Okay? The rest of you are all under church discipline as of today. You see the difference? One has the authority, the weight of an absolute biblical command. The other is a biblical, and I don't know of a better term, but an expectation. I would put giving under that as well. We don't discipline people out of our church because they haven't given in 6 months. No. And this is how I see the difference. A biblical command must be followed. A biblical expectation should be followed. And it's in this expectation that we see our true hunger for God. As I said at the start, simply put, fasting is a way to grow in our pursuit of Christ. That's all it is. When should a Christian fast? A Christian should fast when our hunger for God is great. Our hunger is often revealed in the midst of trials and struggles and grief and contrition. We're in the midst of a difficult trial. Our hunger for God will be most evident. I remember John MacArthur sharing his personal testimony of when his son, his second son, Mark, was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And the initial diagnosis was not good. In fact, they thought that they were going to lose Mark. And he said he went, and this was much after the fact, he went and he fasted for a week. Why? Because he was pleading with God in prayer. Not so much for what he wanted, but as he recalls, it was so that his heart would be in line with what God wanted whenever that time came about. And interestingly enough, after his fast was over, he said that some woman that he had never met before was wandering around the office. And to get to John MacArthur's office, I mean, it's like getting into Fort Knox. You know, I mean, there's alarms and doors and secretaries and more doors and steel curtains and pit bulls and a moat filled with alligators. And then he said there was some woman walking around the office one night after hours, knocked on his door, got into his office, and God had put on her heart to bring John MacArthur a sandwich right at the end of that fast. I just thought that is God's sovereign, divine providence. All right? And he had never seen her after that. So maybe an angel, who knows, all right? But some way that we can hunger for God in the midst of trial is to fast. Another time when we should fast is when our hunger for God is threatened because our appetites for other things are so great. See the difference? Sometimes we fast because we just want God. We need God. We want more of Christ. And other times we fast because our heart is waning away from the primacy of Christ. We fast when we sense idolatry creeping into our hearts, when we want to resist that idolatry. This is what Paul is getting at in 1 Corinthians 9. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. If you're sensing in your heart right now worldliness, materialism, gluttony, hedonism for the things of this world, just ask yourself why. Why? And no doubt there are probably things that God would point you to that are influencing your heart away from Christ. And maybe it would be wise to take a fast from those things. A day, a week. Some of you may need to turn off your television for a week. Again, that's up to you. That's between you and God. There's no regulations. But imagine all the time that you would save and how much more productive you'd be if you just turned off the television for 1 week. Some of you may need to fast from food. Food has become an idol. Some of us may need to fast for other things. But whatever it would be, when our hunger for God is great or when our hunger for God is being threatened by appetite that are now becoming bigger than they should be, I think that is the appropriate time for us as believers to fast. As I mentioned before, it is my heart's desire that we would hunger for God. That's the bottom line. I'm not really interested in being legalistic. Okay, next week we're going to have a little checklist. Those of you who fasted, please sign in. Those of you who didn't, stand in the back. We'll talk to you later. Now, bottom line is that fasting is just a means to a greater aim, which is God. And may it be a viable means for us as we seriously consider Christ's words here in Luke 5, that it could be one expression of many that Christians have to express our hunger and our desire for God. Let's pray. Take a minute, would you, as the praise team comes up.